Cujo. His name's Cujo.
Cujo? Cujo?
Hey, boy.
What kind of dog is he?
St. Bernard.
He's a great dog.
Yeah, he's a pretty smart one, too.
Welcome to this review of Cujo, part of the Percolated Media Stephen King Retrospective Series.
It's not a monster, it's just a doggy.
Join Garrett.
My big guy.
Matt.
Do a real good job and he won't rob you blind.
And Adam.
What the hell are you doing? Who the hell do you think you're talking to?
As they take a deep look at the movie based off Stephen King's 1981 novel about a rabid St. Bernard.
Well, that's not too bad. I mean, it certainly could be worse.
And keep coming back, as the co-hosts will continue going through each of the popular novelist adaptations in publication order.
There's no such thing as real monsters, only in stories.
So tread lightly, podcast listeners.
God, you scared the shit out of me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Assessment of Cujo begins now.
Yeah, okay. We'll try it.
Cujo, release August 12th, 1983. Budget on this was $6 million. Box office, $21.2 million. So we made a profit. And this is directed by Louis Teague. Guys, in 1983, we got a triple dose of King. We got this, and the next one was The Dead Zone, which we've already discussed. And the one after that, which ended the year, was John Carpenter's Christine, which, oh boy, I can't wait to get to that one. But first, we had Cujo. Cujo is an interesting bit of development that was picked up by Dino even before the book was published. He had a lot of confidence in this, and in the lead up to this, he once again commissioned King to write the script, and once again, he did not like what King wrote. Matt, does that surprise you?
No, because you said the words Dino De Laurentiis.
The book, if you hear King in interviews and if you read On Writing, which he published in 2001, this is the book that he least remembers writing. He was deep in, not in drugs yet. He wasn't in the nose candy, as Adam likes to say, just yet. He was more of a drinker. So much of a drinker, guys. He would drink 3 gallons of beer a day, which, Adam, I don't know if combined you and I have had nights like that.
That's what I call football Sunday.
Makes my waist hurt just thinking about it.
Yeah, right. So yeah, he doesn't remember writing this. I read this pretty recently, and the thing about it that sticks out is, A, there's no chapters. You literally have a whole bunch of narrative, and then it's just broken up by paragraph and maybe a couple spaces in between the paragraph. So there's no chapters. Matt, have you read this book?
Long, long time ago, probably mid-high school. So needless to say, it's been a while. But this is one of the books that I have actually read.
Okay, so you did read this. Like King, you don't remember reading it, though. Not for the same reasons.
No, because I remember that I've read it, but if you ask me, there's one discernible difference I remember that glad to remove. But.
Yep. Now, this is one of those books that I think it... Matt, is it safe to say this has the most cultural resonance, right? Because before this movie had come out, nobody really pointed at a dog that was mean and said, oh, that's Cujo. But after this, I know people who have named their dog Cujo. It kind of had a cultural resonance, didn't it?
It certainly did. And unlike a lot of King's work up to this point, you know, we had vampires, we had haunted hotels, we had telekinesis. A rabid dog is one of the most down-to-earth things he had depicted as the antagonistic force in almost all of his work up to this point. So I think the fact that it was a more natural, quantifiable component maybe added to its staying power.
Well, you remember the continuation it had with The Dead Zone, right?
Yeah, and I'm so glad that was cut in the movie.
Me too. Although there's a couple things. A, the sheriff that goes to the house that gets and ends up getting killed by Cujo later in the film, that Sheriff Bannerman, who was played by the much more handsome Tom Skerritt in The Dead Zone. So that's one bit of continuation. Another bit, and they hint at it in this movie, but I'm also glad they cut it. is the fact that Cujo was inhabited by the ghost of Frank Dodd, who was the strangler that was killed in the Dead Zone. I'm glad that was cut as well. Although, you know, King just also in the book, he kind of hints at it, and I think it's more of putting Tad at unease. So that when the dog does attack, like, everything is just kind of cultivating at once, and this kid's fears are coming to life. King does not say it outright, but it's kind of implied. Adam, as somebody who was coming to this for the very first time, you'd obviously heard of Cujo in the past. What exactly did you know going in?
I knew this was a Stephen King book. I knew it was about a dog. And because I swear, watching award shows for 40 years, I've seen that damn clip of the dog jumping at the window about 50 million times. That's all I knew beforehand. Reading trivia afterwards, I learned about the Dead Zone connections and the changes and things like that. But if you've listened to any part of this retrospective with King, you know that no, I have not read this book. But I know it's regarded as a solid, standalone, quality King book. So it's, yeah, I'll say it's definitely been in the zeitgeist ever since. You know, it's kind of like people are scared of the water because of Jaws. People are scared of rabid dogs because of this film. And I'll give it credit for that. It has staying power. And I'm kind of surprised we haven't had as many Cujos as we've had Firestarters over the last 30 years.
Funny you mentioned Firestarter. So in the development of this, there was another director attached, a director by the name of Peter Medak. Now, this guy, a couple years before this, he did a movie starring Adam's pick for most overrated actor, George C. Scott, called The Changeling, which is actually a pretty damn good film. But a couple weeks in, he was kicked off the project. I don't know if it was creative differences with Dino. There's nothing that is really definitive about that. But King, he had say around this time, he has seen a movie that Matt and I have discussed in the past. Not full length, but we discussed when we did Cat's Eye that Louis Teague had done a movie called Alligator, and King thought, you know what, he would do a great job with my rabid dog movie. So he suggested Louis Teague for this movie, and he got on, and then he came back for Cat's Eye a couple years later. So Matt, Peter Medak, different film, right?
Certainly. It would have, I think if he stayed on the project, maybe they would have incorporated those, you know, the supernatural possession ambiguity that might have been a factor. But Louis Teague, I love Alligator. It's not high art, but of all those like Jaws knockoffs, That and Brada are the best two by far.
One more thing I want to mention before we dive into the movie is when we were discussing Marvel Boys a few weeks ago, we mentioned that the marketing for those Kingsman films and a couple of the other ones, it didn't really tell you what the movie was. I think one of the best trailers from the early 80s is the trailer to this movie. If you watch it, it's literally just the swirling label that you see in the beginning here, the swirling title, and just a lot of scary imagery that is shown in it. You don't really know what it's about. Obviously people know what Cujo's about, but back in 1983, if you go to a theater, it's like, whoa. I recommend people check out that trailer. It's pretty remarkable. But Matt, have you watched that trailer?
No, I've seen next to nothing of how this was marketed.
Yeah, I recommend checking it out. It's really good. All right, so we start off with some scary-looking imagery along with Dee Wallace Inn. She gets her name above the title. Don't forget, this was the year after E.T., so of course she's going to get her name above the title. And we have a bit of a fun lace theme going on here as we cut to this rabbit being chased by Cujo. Now, this composer is Charles Bernstein, who had a great theme a year later when he did A Nightmare on Elm Street. This isn't one of his best scores. Adam, how do you feel about the score of Cujo?
Forgettable. It hits its part where it needs to, but this feels like a Dino through and through. He's going to get people that are going to work cheap enough to give him what he wants that he can make a profit.
So Cujo chases the rabbit down a hole and is then bitten by a bat. Ouch. That hurt just watching it.
The hell? Because bats are known to be inside rabbit dens in the ground?
That was the weird thing, right? This rabbit just goes in. It's like he's being protected by these bats. I noticed that while watching this, too.
I know we're literally like 90 seconds into this. And yes, Adam is bitching about a King film. But me, this, and these bats are like, I don't know, 10 feet in. And they get the snout of this dog. I'm just like, okay, underground bats. Hey, more power to them. Okay.
It might as well be the freaking gophers from Caddyshack.
Yeah. We then cut to the Trenton house as we see Danny getting scared by his closet door opening, and he thinks there's a ghost in the house. Now, this little plot point, as I mentioned, it doesn't amount to much here, but as me and Matt discussed earlier, in the book it is the first time literary King worlds united, as is implied that this is the ghost of Frank Dodd from the Dead Zone. Taken from the boy's point of view, we hear that it tells him along the lines of, I will hunt and kill you in the summer. T kind of took a lesson from Kubrick and decided to leave the supernatural element out of the film. Just implies that the dog was rabid, which is why it is out to kill the mom and child later. Adam, How do you feel about the decision to kind of withhold the supernatural element of this?
I think it's the absolute right idea. I think you could have had something really hokey if you put that in. But I'll say, seeing a closet door open and a scared boy, I thought we were connecting and giving an Easter egg to the boogeyman. I don't know if that was written yet.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, but that was my thought. You could do it with a lot of things. I don't think you do it with a dog. I mean, that'd be as ridiculous as, I don't know, having like an evil entity be a car or something. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I've already said my piece. Even when I was reading the book, I'm like, this feels too much like King Inside Baseball with everything being interconnected. And I think given how, I don't want to say bare bones this movie is, but it's certainly one of the most straightforward things he's done. It would feel really off-putting to have a supernatural component in this, especially with how low-key this family is. I mean, they're dealing with real-life issues beyond just a dog trying to kill them. That all, it turns out they were also being hunted by a dog that's possessed by a serial killer. I don't think it would gel quite yet.
By doing this, what you have done is you have made this literally Jaws on land. Now, don't forget, this is 8 years after Jaws had come out. And Matt, you mentioned all the knockoffs. Is it safe to say that Cujo's kind of a Jaws knockoff as well?
Only by the premise of pissed off nature, which is it's a horror subgenre in and of itself. The reason I give it more of a pass here, and I wouldn't accuse it of being a ripoff, is the family dynamics here are explored much more than they ever are in Jaws. I mean, they're there in Jaws, which we'll talk about later this year, but by comparing the first movie to this one, and because it's really only the two of them, like this one's much more of a survival story when you get to the actual, like when Cujo comes into his own. It's much more about just primal survival than Jaws, which that doesn't come into play until the last, 10 minutes of the movie.
Adam, what do you think? Did you get more of a Jaws on land feel here?
Didn't cross my mind. I could see that, especially with E. Wallace being the star here. It almost feels Spielbergian in its classic suburban type of family unit, but I didn't get that just because I feel like there's a reason behind it. Jaws is almost just like monsters run amok. And here, I feel like he kind of just tried to make something that could plausibly happen to try to terrify you.
So let's discuss the two people who are going to be the center point when we get to the actual dog attacking. First, let's go to Dee Wallace. Like I said, she was in this the year after E.T. had come out. So she was everybody's favorite mom around this time. Favorite cinematic mom, anyway. I think she's phenomenal in this. King has been on record around the time as saying she deserved an Academy Award nomination for this performance. I wouldn't go that far, but she has to go through so much throughout the course of this. And I was listening to an interview with her earlier this week, and she said that this shoot was 8 weeks. 4 of it was in the car. And gives the impression that it's hot in that thing. It's not. They're in 40 degree weather. And so they're spraying them to make it look like they're sweating in the hot weather. They're not. The water's actually making them more cold. So they had to put a little heater in the car to actually heat themselves up. But I think Dee Wallace is really good in this.
I mean, considering some of the King movies we've discussed up to this point, this is like an acting tour de force in the equivalency scale. Yeah, this is certainly one of the best performances we've talked about in this retrospective. I mean, I think it really elevates what is a pretty straightforward, I mean, this very well could have been just a straightforward B movie shot with no money. But when you get credible stars that have considerable ability, I think it really elevates the overall presentation of the movie, even though the directing I do think is pretty workmanlike. Because look, Lewis Teague is not on the level of a John Carpenter or Dave Cronenberg, where they got a really particular style. He's just a pretty straightforward filmmaker. So the acting, I think, helps compensate for that.
I think this is a really good directing job, but I'll get to that when we get to the attack scenes later.
I think she actually does a really good job. I think she brings a credibility to the role that I don't care about with any of the other actors. And I think she gets steadily better throughout the course of the film. I do think she's a tour de force. I could see a reason that King would say she deserved a nomination, just because if this was a drama, she would have got it. I think in a different world, you could put her, I don't know, maybe helping to oversee the Overlook, and you get a different feel from that movie. I think she's actually pretty damn tremendous.
Now, while watching this, and this doesn't happen too often, but I thought of Matt a lot while watching this movie, because here we have another kid performance. Danny Pintero. Now, this kid would go on to be Tony Danza's son and Who's the Boss, which is quite a jump after this. I gotta say, man, there are times when we see him later, we'll discuss it when we get to those scenes, but I think he's legitimately terrified. I think he does a really good job in this. I am never annoyed at him when we get to the car scenes. I literally feel for him. I think he's really good. Matt, I have to ask, as somebody who has criticized kid performances on this podcast in the past, how do you feel Danny Pintero is here?
I think they legitimately traumatized this kid because he's that good. I put this on the kid from The Shining. What's that? Is it Danny Lloyd?
Danny Lloyd, yeah.
I'd put it on that caliber. I don't know what it is. A lot of King movies, the best performances come from the kids, and I think this is excellent work. But it's a shame that he didn't really pursue acting as much as he could have, because he didn't make a whole lot of other movies after this.
No, he did that one big TV show, and then he was one of the first people to come out of the closet as well, and I think that kind of hampered his career, unfortunately.
Yeah, because he got outed in that National Enquirer
piece. Yeah, it really hampered his career. It's a shame.
He's a young kid, too. He's, what, 5 in this?
Yeah. Yeah, real young.
5 or 6, so like super, you know, Joel Osment level, mm-hmm. as far as lack of experience. But yeah, I think he's really good. This is not a Cortland Mead situation, but I wanted to actively punch a child in the face. Well, if I did that in that movie, maybe it would have straightened his goddamn teeth out.
Jesus Christ. Adam, how do you feel about the little boy here, sir?
I think he does a really good job. To both your points, it's kind of amazing that they can get this quality acting for these type of roles, and I think it's impressive when you have only a 90 minute movie and 50 to 60 minutes of it is just the mom and son together. You got to have something special, so their chemistry works well together, their acting works well together, and yeah, you know what, it's the 80s. I don't think you could get this kind of performance today, because I do think they treated kids like shit on set to get a performance. They would torture these kids sometimes to really get the shot they wanted. But it works. I believe when he's terrified, and then some of the shit that he goes through towards the end of this film is just harrowing.
Wait till we get to the end. I'll be curious to hear how you feel.
Because they change that.
Yeah. Changes. Yeah.
So Tad's parents comfort him after he gets scared, and we just see him lying in bed scared. We see Tad watching cartoons and eating cereal, and then we get the marketing subplot here. This plays a bigger part in the book. I'll say. I think the book is a pretty good piece of King literature. I really do. I think it's worth reading for anybody who's even curious about King. This was my in with King. When I was a kid, I think I was maybe 11, 12 years old. The video game system that I had was located in my parents' room. So I go in there and I play video games and then leave, because they wanted to monitor, you know, how much I was playing the big games at the time. And I remember standing up and looking over my dad's nightstand and seeing the cover of this book sitting there on his nightstand. And it was the cover that had the movie on it. So it was one of those books, Adam, I know you remember these. Remember the books that had like the black and white photos of the actual movie inside the book when you opened it? Mid part. It was one of those. It was the one they released after this movie had come out. I grabbed it, and this was my in with King, which kind of upset my mom, because I was asking questions about a lot of the sexual nature that goes on in this book. The book is full of fucking just crazy sex and things that we'll talk about as we get deeper into the movie. But
yeah, might as well be a freaking Skinamax
book. It's crazy. Yeah. It was, yeah, just unbelievable. But having said that, this marketing thing going on, Adam, what happens in this is the dad is the head of this agency that is marketing a cereal that has food dye in it, and kids are thinking that they're bleeding to death when they use the restroom because it's coming out red because of the dye they used in the cereal.
Yeah, that's what happens when you eat Captain Crunch after smoking a joint.
So, believe it or not, that plays a big part in the book, a bigger part than what we see here. We see it hinted at here, but it plays bigger because that's why the dad has to leave, and that's why he's not there. I'm glad that Teague and the screenwriters kind of ixnayed that, because it would have kind of downed this movie. Although it does do the job of getting the dad out of the picture, but I'm glad that was cut.
Yeah, same, because you would be asking the question, okay, where's the dad throughout most of this?
Exactly. So, Steve Kemp, guys. Steve Kemp, I think that there's something there. You know, Steve King, Steve Kemp. He's the one who is having the affair with Dee Wallace in this. Now, Christopher Stone, this actor, he was Dee Wallace's husband at the time. He remained her husband until he died, unfortunately, while she was filming The Frighteners. Here we have Steve challenging Vic to another tennis match. The match happens, and we cut to Donna in bed, not with Vic, but with Steve. So we have soap opera stuff going on here. King's intent was to revolve a horror story around a Days of Our Lives type plot line. Adam, how do you feel this affair and everything goes with this story?
I don't understand the what or the why. It feels so inserted poorly that it just, I don't get why I'm supposed to care about this. The thing is, in this movie, it's needed, because you need to fill this out, because this thing is thin, and I don't know if there's enough to hold together a feature-length film. Am I supposed to not like the mom because she's having an affair? Because that's generally why you have a cheating spouse in a film so that you don't like them. And then how am I supposed to feel about this other guy? And the dad knows but doesn't and then leaves. And then later on when the dude shows up at that, I don't know. I think it's poorly done. And the inclusion just left me scratching my head.
Here's the difference between a book and a movie. Because in the book, what this affair does when the dog attacks later is has Donna questioning whether the attack on her and her son is God punishing her for her mistake that she did with this affair. I think that works in the context of a book. But I think in this movie, it doesn't work. Because you're exactly right, Adam. In the context of this movie, this doesn't have any consequence as to what happens at the end. It really doesn't, especially given the change they make at the end.
When I'm watching it, the only thing that pops into my mind, because I know how much he puts himself in there, is I'm like, is Stephen King the cheater or the one that was cheated on? Because that's the only thing I could think of. I see no other reason that it's here.
Yeah, I think in the book, reading it as like atonement for her sins, you know, you can really explore that because with a book, you have so much time to fill and you get into the subconscious because you can get inside her head and, you know, have that inner dialogue. Here, it's just a plot device. And I think that's part of that is just because I really think this story would have been a perfect inclusion in Cat's Eye.
Mm.
Yes.
Not just because he directed Cat's Eye, but this type of enclosed, claustrophobic, you know, legitimately tense story works really well as a 30-minute chapter. But trying to stretch it to 90 minutes, that's a considerable challenge. I mean, that's why a lot of the movies that do this type of thing are less than 90 minutes. You know, I think of stuff like Open Water or even this movie Fall I watched recently, which is one of the only times I've gotten like vertigo from watching them.
God, that movie.
Except I hated the twist in it. That was bullshit. Love to talk about that at some point. But yeah, I think it's one of the things of they contrived it just to pad out the story.
Do you remember how this is resolved in the book, Matt?
No, because it's been a long time since I've read it.
So what happens is when she breaks the affair off, she tells him that's enough. And later on, the house is empty because the dad's gone, Vic's gone, and of course, Tad and Donna are stuck in the car. What happens is he goes to the house, and we see it in the movie a little bit where he thrashes it. But in the book, you don't remember this, Matt, at all?
No, I was like 13 when I read this.
In the book, he goes to the bed, and he freaking jerks off on it. To kind of leave his mark, so to speak.
Yeah, he's like a dog sitting on the lawn.
Yeah, he's an angry dude in that book. Wow, pretty intense. Thank God they left that out here. So Teague does a slow push in on the family from outside the house as they're eating dinner. And then we see that Donna's mentioning the possibility of having another baby. And Tad does an impression of a movie that we'll be covering later on this year. This is a flat out call out to the fact that, yes, this is Jaws on Land, people. I thought it was kind of adorable. So Vic brings the car to the car place, but they're too busy to take it. So the mailman recommends he take it to Joe Camber's place. And we cut to him driving to the Camber's place, and the boy calls his mom over. And guys, you guys recognize Mr. Camber? Mr. Ed Lauder here? Kind of funny. Donna greets Mrs. Camber as we see Cujo approach the family, and the boy is happy as a clam to see him. He tells Donna that Cujo won't hurt them. He's a nice dog. Sure he is.
Yeah, that's like those idiots who let their kids hang out with gorillas at the zoo.
Well, it should be said, St. Bernards are nice dogs.
Oh, yeah, they're lovable dogs.
Mm-hmm. But this movie did so much to hurt their reputation that it didn't really regain it until 10 years later when Beethoven came out.
Yeah, I feel like Beethoven was made by actual St. Bernards because they were getting so much bad press.
By the way, they were handled by the same handler who did this movie as well, so...
They're fucking huge.
Yeah, they are.
Like they're basically like those in Newfoundlands are like these big lovable dogs, but unfortunately they don't live very long because they're so big.
Yeah,
which is why there's like 8 Beethoven movies.
Yeah.
And this blew me away because my entire life I thought I had assumed that Cujo was the family dog because that just made sense to me. So I had no idea that they were going to a place that it was somebody else's dog. So I'm just like, wait, what? What? I had to rewind it to understand what was going on for me.
And again, this is another thing that is really played with in the book where we're going to see later that the woman of this family, which by the way is exactly how I envisioned her as I was reading this thing, she ends up winning $5,000 in a lottery, which back in 1983, that's a lot of money.
I'll take it now.
Yeah, you're right. But they leave, and so their lives are fine after this. And the Trenton family at the end is not, and the centerpiece is the dog. So I see the symmetry that King is playing with here, but it doesn't come off that much in the movie. So Tad says hi to Cujo, and we're hearing how smart St. Bernards are. We see Vic tell off the monsters in Tad's closet as he sets them down into bed. Vic then gets into bed with Donna, and she says how good Vic is with Tad. We get more on the cereal ads and how badly they're going. Vic is unhappy about the whole thing, and Donna says that he'll work it out because he always does. We see that Vic and his partner, Roger, they're wrestling with the backlash from the ad campaign that's gone horribly wrong as they've lost a Sharp account. Again, this is more played upon in the book. We cut to Cujo looking over at Joe Camber as he's cutting through some wood, and in the book we get some Okay, here's something I need to talk
about. Yes, I do remember. Okay. The dog has like inner monologues.
Well, on the surface, that sounds awful. But I gotta tell you, in reading it this time, Adam, to kind of clear up, in the book, we have a lot of internal thought from the dog. Like, he'll call Donna the woman. He'll call Tad the boy. What we're seeing in that inner dialogue is the rabies taking over his brain. Because he is not out for blood like the movie is implying in the book. In the book, he is trying to get rid of the noises that are hurting his head. So he determines that those noises are coming from Donna and the boy and the people that come to the house later. So in reading it this time, I remember laughing at it originally, but here it works for me. And again, in a movie, you can't really do that.
No, and that's why you don't do it in the movie, because that would have been, I mean, you're basically turning it into All Dogs Go to Heaven then if you're doing I understand that doing that in the context of a book, but trying to do that in a movie like this, people would have laughed at it. I mean, you might as well have had the guys, I think it's Art Carney and Homeward Bound, doing voiceover. Like, that's basically what this would have been if you tried to execute that.
That would have been a really bad choice. I can appreciate it from a book standpoint, because rabies doesn't just make an animal turn into a bloodthirsty killing machine, you know? It affects their mental status and puts them in a lot of pain, and that's why they act out. So it's trying to play it both ways, and I appreciate that when we get Cujo reacting to the sounds, that's part of reality. But yeah, to do that in a movie would just, oh, that'd be something different.
So we see Donna confront Steve and tell him that she can't see him anymore. And I already talked about what he does in retaliation. Steve says, okay, whatever you want, as he leaves.
Because it affects what happens later on quite a bit that I don't understand. She calls him like the town stud. So it's hinted that he's just like sleeping with every woman that wants the affair. So for him to be so attached to her, I just don't get later on, because it seems completely out of character that he's just turned psycho over this one woman that wants to end the affair if he's sleeping with everybody in town.
Vic happens to drive by as Steve confronts Donna, but then he turns around and says that he doesn't see anything. Donna picks up Tad, who tells her that he got hit by a swing earlier in the day. The car starts acting up as they drive home, but Vic is home. He sends Tad to get his mitt and asks Donna what she did today. We then cut to Cujo waking up and seeing a truck pull up. Joe gets out and confronts his family, and he just comes off as a real asshole here. And then Charity reveals that she won $5,000 in the lottery, and she tells him that she wants to go away with Brett for the week to see her sister. We then see Vic pull up in his Jaguar to pick up Tad. Now, this was weird. Vic's driving a Jaguar. Donna's driving a Pinto. What's wrong with this picture here?
What's wrong is that the Pinto doesn't explode in this movie.
Yeah.
Because all I can think of is that scene in Top Secret where gently touch the back of the Pinto and it explodes, because that's what those cars actually did.
Yeah.
Because the design, these idiots put the fucking gas tank where the engine is.
It should be said that King had a Pinto when he was a teacher and way before he was a big rich writer. I mean, so
they were legitimately fire starters.
Yeah. Nice. Tad says that he's not having fun at summer camp and he wants to go home. Now, we sure are getting a lot of buildup here. Adam, as somebody who's coming into this movie for the first time, were you expecting this dog to attack from the beginning? What are you thinking as all this family drama is going on?
Where's my note here? What is this drama? I am fucking bored. It's not what I'm expecting when I know that I'm getting a killer dog movie. Yeah, I want to see Cujo get built up, but even that doesn't really happen in a way that I appreciate. I understand you got to set up the family, you got to set up that I care, but I don't care about, okay, so he's driving a sports car, she's driving a Pinto, and they're so hard up, they got to drive to this farm, but that family leaves, but this family's here, dad's got it, and then Cujo, there's one scene that I'm supposed to be a little scared at, but I'm not, because I'm not a freaking 6-year-old child. So it's not hitting me at this point at all.
I'm not as bored as Adam, but I can certainly understand that critique.
You gotta understand, I've heard about this movie for 40 years. I'm used to that image of Cujo, that killer dog. So we're like 30 minutes into this film and his nose is barely starting to drip, you know?
Steve shows up and pretty much tries to rape Donna, and she yells at him to leave her home. And then Tad runs in along with Vic. Steve walks out and Donna reveals that yes, they did have an affair. We cut to Vic testing the car, and Tad tells him that he doesn't want him to go. He says only he knows the monster words, and he says that he'll copy the monster words so that his mom can read them for him at night. Vic tells Donna to run the car to the Cambers in order for it to be fixed, and we cut from Tad sleeping to a fog-infested house as Brett walks out and hears a howl. He goes to investigate, and this shot of Cujo emerging from the fog, I love it. We need to mention, Matt, do you know who the DP was for this?
Yeah, it's Jean DeBont, who was like a last-minute replacement.
Jean DeBont, yes. He came in. Teague was, as I mentioned, he was a last-minute replacement. He came in literally 2 weeks into this shoot. And Peter Medak took his DP with him, and they were against the wall. He pulled Jean DeBont to do the photography for this. And anybody who knows Jan DeBont knows that he did Die Hard, and he went on to direct Speed and Twister and Speed 2 and The Haunting. But at this point, he was a very well-respected DP. I think, as far as looks go, there are some glorious shots in this movie, starting with this shot in the fog.
Yeah, I think it's shot really well, especially once we get here to the farm. And then later on, once we get into the car, it is shot stunningly well for what this movie is. Like, it's and especially the camera movement, the shot here emerging, I think is done really well. The attack, I just can't stand the way that it's shot. I understand you need to feel like the ferociousness of it. Look, it worked fine in 83. It doesn't work fine in the 2020s.
Well, you have to remember too that Saint Bernards are notoriously nice dogs.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, no, this is like growing up and we had a Rottweiler and people were scared to death and it would jump and throw you to the ground and lick you to death.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
So, yeah, I get the reason they have to do it. It just doesn't scare me.
I think the editing of this is pretty good. I think when the dog attacks, again, they brought in 6 dogs here, depending on who you ask. It's changed over the years. I've heard anywhere from 12 to 3 to 5 to 6. So anywhere between 3 to 12 dogs were involved in the making of this movie. You had one who walked towards the camera. You had one that was nice. They even had a mechanical head done for when it runs into the car later. There are a lot of dogs involved here, but you also have to realize that they are trained. Yet, at times, and there's only a couple times where I noticed it, but I noticed it while watching it for this podcast, you can see the tail wag when it's attacking a couple times because there's some very good meat right off the set there. But I think as far as editing goes, I think this is edited really well. I am actually scared of the dog. I think the attack scenes are very good. Matt, be the tiebreaker here. How do you feel about the dog attack scenes?
Depends on which dog they're using. The mechanical dog, I think, is pretty obvious. Although, if you listen to the kid, they didn't know any better when they were shooting the movie. But it also depends on the angles that they're using. The more under shots or when the dog is jumping, I think those are the most distracting ones.
So, Cujo's starting to look a little worse for wear here, and he starts growling and barking. Now, to make him look, later on, he's going to look really bad. And what they did was they covered these dogs in egg white and sugar to get that look. The problem is when you do that to a dog, when you put that stuff on, they want to lick it off because they like the taste of it. So they had to really make sure that they cut at the exact right time or they would catch him licking the stuff off his face, which I thought was actually kind of adorable. But I think they do a pretty good job of making Cujo look deteriorated.
Yeah, I think it's totally fine. It is what it is. There's only so much you can do.
Yeah, and I like that it escalates throughout the course of the film. You see his degeneration, and I think that's a great move.
We cut to Vic leaving for 10 days as he tells Tad and Donna goodbye. She reassures him that the affair is over, but Vic replies with he doesn't know what he's going to do.
Good for him.
Yeah, right?
Leave them there.
Exactly. Meanwhile, Brett and Charity, they're packing the rest of their things as Brett tells her that he's worried about Cujo. But Charity tells him to leave him be, and when they get back, he'll be just fine. We have more shots of Cujo just roving the hills, and we're at the 43-minute mark, and we finally get our first kill. He goes after Gary, this friend of Joe's, as he jumps on him and completely mauls him. He then tears through his plastic covering and mauls him again until he's completely dead. So, Adam, you're not into this attack scene, huh?
No, this one I'm really not. If I was younger, if I had not, yeah, I'd be scared. I'm not saying that that holds throughout this entire film, because I think this movie hits a pivot point that ratchets up everything and sucks me in. But all of this, I don't care. I'm not scared. I see it coming. I don't think the kills are shot particularly well here.
I'm not crazy about the jerky camera work. It reminds me of that scene in another Stephen King property we'll do where someone turns into a dog and attacks a security guard and it makes you laugh.
Oh, yeah. We see Joe call for Cujo as he pours out the rest of his dog food. Joe then goes to Gary's place and finds him mauled to death, which I think there's some pretty good makeup effects here at the after effects.
For what's, a short, I'm going to call it a value-made movie, being that we know it's Dino De Laurentiis, I save money. I think the makeup and effects work is top for the money they were probably given.
Yeah, $6 million to make this thing, and all of it's on screen. So Joe stands up and makes his way through the house. He grabs the phone and Cujo confronts him. Joe realizes that Cujo's rabid, and we see a POV shot of Joe before we cut to the outside of the house and hear the snarls and bites from right outside the house. We cut to Donna pulling up to the Cambers' house as her car is sputtering until it finally dies. Tad wonders if anyone's home, and Donna gets out, and we have a nice revolving shot of Donna outside the car as she's wondering where anyone is. Again, just great work by Jan DeBon here.
Yeah, this is the same guy who would make Tomb Raider 2. How is the mic?
Which we'll cover!
It's shot well.
Tad's seatbelt gets stuck as Donna reaches over to help him, and they are attacked by Cujo for the very first time. Man, Donna closed the driver's side door as Cujo approaches from that side. Oh, what a nightmare. Not just the fact that they're being attacked by this huge dog, but the claustrophobic nature of being trapped in this small place. A burning hot car as your kid screams and cries out of fright. Oh my God, this got to me. Adam, how are you feeling at this point?
Suddenly works amazingly well. Maybe it's because I didn't care about the other characters, or because it's so open, or because I'm trying to follow the convoluted way that we're going to get to here. And I didn't expect to be brought in, because I've seen the car, I've seen the dog, I've seen all that, like I said before, a million times in clips of so many things. So I did not expect that this would actually hook me. But as soon as Cujo shows up, as soon as they're trapped in this car, hook, line, and sinker.
Here on out, the movie starts to function to its fullest potential, but that's also just because there's not much time left. We're at the halfway point, so now it can function almost like an extended TV episode with this premise.
You knew what got to me while watching it this time. This is why the visual medium actually works for this film. And I mentioned earlier that you can't do a lot of the internal dialogue and everything that happens, but just the shots they do of this car and how close in proximity it is to this house. Donna doesn't have that far to go to get to safety, but she has a couple issues. One, her son's in the car, scared to death. And two, can she really get there before the dog gets to her? And I think it's really implied by Wallace's performance too, that safety's so close, but so far.
Yeah, you could see it in the shots, even of her there. You see it in the shot. It might as well be a million miles away.
We get a slow pan out of the car in this wide open space as Cujo just sits and waits.
Stalker Cujo cracks me up. Like, I understand. I understand it's not how a rabid dog would act, but this is how a dog that was left home alone would act.
For sure.
Who wants to play?
Mm-hmm. We see Tad drawing something as Donna is sitting worried at the wheel. She says that she'll go ahead and try turning the car on as Cujo approaches. It works, and Wallace has a great line here. She pauses and says, "Fuck you, dog." Which is even what is even better is as she starts rolling forward, the car dies yet again.
The difference in trouble lights that come on, they mean nothing to anybody that's watching this now. Yeah. However, seeing that alternator light come on, I'm like, yeah, now you're screwed. You can wait for a car to cool down from being overheated. That alternator's out. You're fucked.
This is where Donna just completely loses it. It should be said that I mentioned that they spent 4 weeks in this fucking car. Afterwards, Dee Wallace went through so much, she calls it emotional trauma in doing this and getting to that place. She was treated for exhaustion right after this. She went all out in this movie, and it definitely shows.
No, you're right. And also there's the, not just the dog, but dehydration and heat stroke. So they're really on a ticking clock in every way. So it's not just the dog, but it's also that false degree of, oh, it's right there. It's like that scene in Toy Story where Woody and Buzz can run through the hallway, but the dog is standing there. Mm-hmm. It's not like Jaws where you're in the middle of fucking nowhere and you're screwed. This, it's like, oh, it's so close, but it's so far away. It's kind of like that movie with James Franco where he has to cut his arm off.
Oh my God. 127 hours.
Yeah. Where it's like, you got to do that thing, and it's so close. You think, oh, I can just pull my arm out, and then you're like, nope.
Tad asks if Cujo can get them while they're in the car, as in eating his way in, and Donna assures him that he can't. More shots of the dog just sitting and waiting for his food to come out of the car, which, as Adam mentioned, is kind of amusing, just stalker Cujo roaming around here.
Yeah, Doc's just trolling her at this point.
Yeah, exactly. We cut to Vic at a payphone trying to call home as he sits down to eat with Richard. Meanwhile, Tad says that he needs to go pee, and Donna tells him to open the door just a crack so he can pee outside. And we see this from Cujo's point of view. He hears a phone ring from inside the house, and he goes after the house door. And that's the thing. Safety, again, is so close, but Cujo just won't let that happen. It should also be said, too, in addition to all the dogs here that they use, they also use a guy in a dog suit. And
taking it back to The Shining. Oh, damn it, that was a bear.
Nice reference, sir. I'm proud of you for that one. I think Teague does a good job here. Obviously, this is used when the dog has to interact with Donna. At one point, he gets on two legs and kind of attacks her. But I couldn't tell in watching this.
I think with very, very rare exception, and unless you're looking for it, I don't think you can tell when they're using the St. Bernard or the Rotties or the man in a suit. I think it's actually done quite well to keep the look of Cujo pretty consistent. I love that he's getting more and more deteriorated by the disease, but no, I think Cujo looks great throughout.
Yeah, you'd think a guy in a suit would be really discernible, but it's not. I think because it was edited pretty well.
Donna wakes up and sees Cujo right outside her window as if he's daring her to come outside. We then cut to a kid riding his bike as the phone at the Tretton house is once again ringing to no end. Donna gives Tad the monster words as Cujo is once again stalking on the outside, and Donna is just staring him down. She says that she's scared to try starting the car again as the battery is very weak, which proves to be the case because it just won't start. She says that when the mailman shows up, they'll head home. We then cut to the mailman picking up his mail for the day and heading out. This was a more prominent character in the book to the point where King, for some reason, wanted to really dote on the fact that this guy had a major gas problem in his mail truck. So I remember just reading about that. I was like, oh boy, King, you're really going for the guster here. Donna tries wheeling Cujo back to the barn as the phone rings yet again, but instead of heading to the house, he runs headfirst right into the car a couple times before trying to jaw his way in, and this shot of the window caving in behind Donna is startling. These attacks, I'm sorry, even for 1983, I'm watching these and I'm like, wow, these are actually very well filmed.
These, I think, are great. Mm-hmm. I think there's a difference here between these and when we see him attack the people earlier in the film. I think these are fantastic. I think it's shot well. Maybe it's because you're able to have him attack up against a static object like the car. The way that the car is cut so they get filmed the way they do is fantastic. We get to this car, and this film is claustrophobic, it's scary, and you feel the drama. I didn't like the first half drama-ness of this film, but I feel what Dee is bringing throughout and what Pintar is bringing here. As a kid, and I know he starts to be asleep for a good part of this or coma, but damn, these two really carry what's going on.
Yeah, I'm fully with it at this point.
We then see Cujo trying to attack them from the roof of the car before jumping down, and Tad is at this point traumatized. And I'm with you guys, man. Look, Pintero, for all we know, he could have been one of those lost actors who he could have had a tremendous career because of how good he is here, but there's no way you could not get away from this shoot not being traumatized by what you're going through here. We see Vic worried about his family as Richard is still busted up about the campaign. We cut to Donna making sure Tad is asleep before wrapping her hand and trying to get out of the car. The door opens and she looks around a bit before walking out. We're seeing POVs of her feet from under the car as she looks at the house and starts making her way there. But she pauses to look under the car before Cujo sees and attacks her. He gets her shoulder as she uses the door to shield herself, and then he makes his way inside the car and gets on top of her, much like he did with Gary earlier. He bites her leg and is pulling her outside before she pushes it outside and closes the door, all while Tad is screaming in the background. Oh, what a fucking attack here. Jesus Christ, this is intense. And then, to punctuate it, we're having this rotating shot from inside the car that just implies the horror of it all and apparently makes Vic wake up, which was funny. But I'm also feeling with this rotating shot that we're seeing Donna was just bitten, so maybe the rabies are going through her.
That's what I thought, and that to me was as scary as anything else. I thought that Mom was going to start succumbing to the rabies. Mm-hmm. And if it's not supposed to be, I think you're at least supposed to be worried about it because it's that same type of bite. I think she's either going to die or she's going to start to foam at the mouth here the next day.
Foam at the mouth. He thought she was going to turn into a raging St. Bernard, huh?
I thought she was at least going to start going crazy.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's Stephen King, so that wouldn't surprise me.
Vic then tells Richard that he's leaving to go home, and Richard attributes it to panic. Vic tells him that Donna has been having an affair, and the fact that she hasn't answered the phone means that she might not be done. Richard begs him to not leave the Sharp account, but Vic leaves anyway. We see Donna wrapping her leg up, and the book is more focused on the fact that she may have rabies, Adam, as you just mentioned, and it's just kind of looked at as a flesh wound here, though. Like, it's not really treated with any real danger here.
Yeah, they set it up, but don't go back to it. Mm-hmm. So after a few minutes, it's pretty clear that they're not going
to
do it.
And to kind of cut to the end of the book, at the end of the book, a lot of the wrap-up is her getting checked for rabies and wrapping that story up. We see Donna beg God to allow her to get out of here as we cut to the sun raising yet again. It beams on Donna's face as she looks behind her, and we see Tad having a seizure. Great job by Pintero here. She can't get him outside as Cujo is there, and she begs him to breathe. This is tough stuff to watch. And anyone who's had kids who has seizures, this is really tough.
Or even shit like asthma or...
Yeah. We cut to Steve going to the Trenton house, and I already mentioned what he does here in the book. Here we just see him brushing his hand across some knives, and we cut to Vic coming home and seeing his house ransacked. We see the police investigating the house, and Vic is sure Kemp did it. And hey, we get a deep throat from X-Files sighting here, right, Matt?
I totally forgot about this.
Though. Yeah, me too. We then cut to the Camber house again as Sheriff Bannerman, once again, straight from the dead zone, he shows up to investigate what's going on. He's not there 10 seconds before Cujo shows up and completely tears him apart. Adam, is the fact that this is away from the car, is this, again, just one of those nyeh attacks?
Funny, it is, and I didn't think about it because it was away from the car. I'm just like, you got two men. Nothing else seems to be able to fight off this dog. You might as well make him supernatural because, I don't know, use your gun. You know, Dee Wallace had a better time being able to physically fight off the dog than this grown man.
This once again causes Donna and Tad to lose it. We cut to Vic, and Steve claims that he didn't see Donna and Tad, though he admits to trashing the house. Someone says that they should be hearing from Bannerman anytime. This causes Vic to once again get in his Jag and take off. We cut back to Donna, who's waking up. She tries waking Tad up, but he's not doing so. We hear her say that she's losing her baby, which causes her to get out of the car and limp up to confront Cujo. She grabs a bat and challenges him as she backs away, and we get some Cujo POV as she bats away at him and even hits him a few times before stumbling back, and now he's on top of her. But she's able to plunge the broken end of the bat into Cujo as her momentum takes them backwards. She grabs Bannerman's gun and realizes that she's locked out of her car with her son trapped inside, so she uses the gun to shatter the back window. Adam, how are you feeling about this attack? This shot, by the way, of her breaking this window straight from the trailer.
Yeah, I like the shot of her breaking the window. However, parents, please do not break the window directly above your child where he's laying. Please use a side window and unlock the door. Don't have the shards of glass falling directly on your six-year-old child. As I put it down, this boss mama fight where she decides that she's going to fucking play baseball with Cujo's head. This is badass boss mama, which is not something we get a lot. Oh, no, never mind. This is Wendy going back up the stairs.
Yeah.
Damn it. Cujo, give me the bat. Fuck, I don't mean to keep going back to the shiny, but oh, that just hit me. I like this. I like mom taking it into her own hands to defend her son against this crazed killer, even though the crazed killer just happens to be a dog. I think this is pretty damn effective.
Donna carries Tad into the house before laying him down and wetting him down as well. She yells for him to wake up and does CPR on him as Vic pulls up. All
this
right.
This scene cracked me up. Hang on, before there. Mm-hmm. This entire, I want to feel for the mom. She's moistening the rag. She's trying to get water into Tad. But I can't help knowing that this film is partially funded by Kellogg because the cornflakes logo is center of frame so much that I'm like, oh man. This scene was brought to you by Cornflakes and the Milk Foundation.
This is kind of like Jason getting up for one last swing, because I'm like, this dog just won't friggin' die. She doesn't feel overpowered. I like that the dog still feels like it could kill her at any moment. And I mean, you could argue that the placement of a bat being very convenient, but I'm willing to let that slide.
All right, here we go. So in the book, Donna is so intent in this battle with Cujo and getting to this house that she completely just leaves Tad in the car. And Tad ends up crawling into the trunk. At the end, when the dog's dead, Donna and Vic go to the trunk and open it, and Tad's dead. They drag him into the house. They try doing CPR like Donna does here, but he dies. King said that he never got more hate letters than when this book came out, and people were furious that he killed this kid at the end. But he said he doesn't outline these. He just takes the characters where he takes them, and before he knew it, the kid died. But Teague ran the idea of letting Tad live by King, and King gave his blessing. How do you guys feel about the fact that Tad doesn't die here?
I think it's the right choice. It would have been so nihilistic to kill Tad off. Like, that would have pissed me off too. So I think the change is right.
I guess. I mean, I think it's fine either way, but I could see how that would be too nihilistic even for this.
This isn't the end of Cujo, though. And of course, for cinematic reasons, we got to do this. He makes one last ditch effort to get them into the house, but we see Donna shoot at him.
I had no idea this was coming.
Yeah. We see Vic find Donna and Tad walking out of the house as the film freezes on the three of them and credits roll on Cujo. Not the nihilistic ending of the book, for sure.
No, but it's like, okay, everyone leave.
Yeah.
Show's over.
Ended like the brakes on that freaking Jaguar. This thing just stopped.
That does it for Cujo. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give this movie? I got to go to the one I've been looking forward to the most because this is his first time viewing. Go to my best friend of 30 years, Adam Bunch. How do you feel, sir?
I was prepared to rag on this movie because it just seems one of those touchstone films that I'm like, oh, yeah, whatever. Time of its time. I've seen so many parts of it. Yada, yada. And I'll admit, for the first like 30 minutes, I'm pretty damn bored of this film. I don't need the Spielbergian family drama setup, even though I understand it plays a part in the final part of this film. I think it's really just there to extend the length of this movie. I do not think this is a feature-length story. I had it in my notes, and Matt perfectly hit it earlier. Put this in Cat's Eye. Put this in some... Shit, find a way to put it in Creepshow. Some way to make it a short story. I think it's better. But this isn't bad. This is actually pretty damn good. The setup, the contrivances to get people into one spot to make the other family leave, you kind of got to let that go. But once we get into the car with mother and son and a killer stalking them outside, and it doesn't matter if it's Jason Voorhees, it doesn't matter if it's Cujo, it doesn't matter if it's Frankenstein, you got a killer stalking them outside this car. This movie turns on a dime. It gets intense. It gets claustrophobic. It gets scary. The acting from them both is pretty damn top notch. The filmmaking and editing from that point on just seems so much better. And the second half of this film really redeems what I thought was a pretty rote first half. I like this film quite a bit, and I'm glad I stuck with it. I was glad I was able to put my phone down once the Pinto sputtered out, and this thing moves from the Pinto to the Vette for the second half. And Cujo's a pretty damn good watch. I'm giving it a 7. I think you could streamline some parts or make it a little more interesting, because the dad, the cheating affair, none of that matters in the end. But a mother defending her son against a killer, this shit really works. So 7 on 10, good time for Cujo.
Wow, 7 from the non-King fan. Matt, as the semi-King fan, how do you feel about Cujo?
Pretty close. I mean, I feel like I'm riding shotgun with him throughout this episode. I do think that it suffers from trying to justify or come up with a way to extend the runtime. Now, the book is also substantial. It's like 300 plus pages, but it's not The Stand. So I wonder if there was a way they could have, I don't want to say trimmed it down, but maybe if you weren't going to do a divorce thing, you have them on a road trip or something to explain like the car breaking down in the middle of nowhere. Maybe there's certain ways to get around it. But as it is, I mean, I don't feel the length to the extent where I'm bored. But it's just one of those things where the second half is so much more engaging than the first half. But that's baked into the premise by its very nature. So I think it's fun. It's workmanlike. It's certainly well acted, especially in comparison to some of the crap we've had to watch. I'm going to give it a 7 as well. I certainly recommend it, but I don't think it's one of the best Stephen King adaptations, but I think it's certainly one of the better ones. I mean, look, comparing this to any of the Children of the Corn movies, it's not even a debate.
Wow. I hate the fact that we're all lockstep, but I have the exact same score written down. Let me explain my reasons why. I do think the film suffers from trying too much to be a Jaws on Land type of film. I think leaving out the supernatural quotient is both good and bad. It's good because, as you guys mentioned, we have stripped it down to a dog with rabies attacking this mother and child. Kind of bad because we're not really given any reasons why, other than the fact that the dog has rabies. In the film, in the book, as I mentioned, he's trying to make the pain go away. But as it is, I think we have gotten a tremendous performance from Dee Wallace. And a few years ago, when we were at the other place, I actually interviewed the daughter of Dee Wallace, and I talked about this a lot with her, and she said that, yeah, her mom was traumatized after this, and I can see why. She is giving her all in a film where, let's face it, like I mentioned, she was the top bill. She was above the credits. She is the head of this film, and she carries the film very well. I think without that performance, though, there are some really bad dangling threads here. I think a lot of the, as you guys have mentioned, the affair stuff doesn't really amount to much. I don't get the symmetry that I got in the book of the Camber family and the Trenton family, what happens to both of those, because Tad doesn't die. Donna does not pay for what she did with her child's life, which, Matt, you and I have had a lot of discussions about the fact that when Spielberg did Jurassic Park, he was scared to kill any of the kids, but in his younger years, he killed Alex Kittner in Jaws. They went the easy route here by not doing it, but God, wait till we get to The Mist. You'll get a really bad ending. Here, I think it works because this film and this book, quite honestly, are pretty nihilistic. He goes into some dark places in this era of his writing, but I think Lewis Teague elevates it with some tremendous directing choices. Now, I'm not going to say Lewis Teague is one of our lost, forgotten great directors, but what I will say is with this assignment, I think he did really well. Would Medic have done well with this? I think he would have, but a lot of the choices that Teague does here, especially given the fact that we didn't have CGI, we had six very nice dogs along with a mechanical dog and everything else that had to be edited to look like a ferocious beast. And in that aspect, once they get in the car, to Adam's point, this movie turns on a dime and we are fearing for these people's lives. I think it is one of the better King adaptations. I'm not going to say it's as good as The Dead Zone. I think I had a better time with The Dead Zone, but I think I'm going to give it the same score of a 7. I'm not going to say I had a great time watching this, but I will say that it was good to go back to thrills. King had kind of delved into science fiction. We talked about it with Firestarter. We kind of talked about it with The Dead Zone too. And it was good to see a horror quotient done to somebody who is quoted as being the master of horror. So 7 out of 10 for Cujo. Okay, so Cujo is released, kind of forgotten about, and then around the 2010s, the mid-2010s, we were getting hints that they were going to bring Cujo back. Matt, had you heard about what they were going to do with this?
No, I just know it's happening because of course it is.
Well, the remake is actually happening, yes, but what they were going to do with this, you guys are going to laugh your asses off. I just mentioned that King disregarded the sci-fi quotient for this film and went for thrills and scares. What they're going to do? They're going to call it, you ready? C period, U period, J period, O period. It was going to go science fiction, and they were going to take these dogs and pretty much make them government attack dogs. That was the idea that they were writing for quite a while. It has since been disbanded, but Matt, could you imagine taking this into a science fiction realm?
I think it would kind of betray the whole premise, to be honest.
Exactly.
This is supposed to be something that could happen to any family's pet. So doing that, one, is horrible. Two, yeah, I'm not surprised. I guess bring back the shop and have them inject the dogs with that serum they're given in Firestarter.
Yeah.
I mean, shit, I just wrote the series.
Thank God they disregarded that idea. But, of course, given the fact that we are remaking all of King's early works, Netflix did announce in March that they are doing a remake of this. Now, there have been good remakes of his works, but Matt, how do you feel about the prospect of us getting another Cujo?
I mean, I'm not surprised. This is one of the few that hasn't really been, I should say one of the few, but this one seems one of the easier ones to remake because it's such a simple premise. So, I mean, I guess I'll be optimistic. I don't think it's the dumbest idea.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I think they'll change the dog. They'll try to make it something a little more fluffy again. It'll be like a Labradoodle or a Bernedoodle. It'll be a Bernedoodle. Shit, that is exactly what it's going to be. However, I'm really glad that the person that they chose to direct it is Darren Aronofsky, because that means I don't have to see it for at least 6 years, because he's going to be coming off this project until 2030.
It's never going to happen.
Yeah, I'm with Matt. He attaches himself to so many of these goddamn projects, and before we know it, he's off. You know what? I think with a modern aesthetic, it could work, but we run into the same problem with all of these. Here, the phone is in the house. They have no way of getting to the phone. How the hell are they going to do this with the aspect of having cell phones available? You know, you're going to run into that problem unless they make it a period piece, which they could.
I left my phone in the house. I didn't bring my cell phone. Yeah. And yeah, because sure, like not every six-year-old also has a cell phone. I mean,
yeah.
It doesn't feel feature length. If you were to remake this and package it with something else, imagine a Stephen King film coming out annually or every other year that was an anthology of three stories. Like, fuck, that would work. I'd go see that.
So, yeah, we're going to get that in a set of years, and we'll be there to cover that. But next week, oh, are we going to have fun next week? Not only are we going to get to talk about King's alter ego, Richard Bachman, for the first time. And I'll get into all the reasons why he did that and the reasons that have been given over the years. The story's changed a bit over the years. But Matt is also going to, for the first time since Batman and Robin, get to talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yes, next week we are going to be discussing 1987's The Running Man. Oh my God, do we have things to say? And it won't be the last time we discuss The Running Man this year, because towards the end of the year, we are getting an Edgar Wright remake of The Running Man. We'll get into all our thoughts on that prospect next week. But Matt, what are you expecting when we get to talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger's The Running Man next week?
I don't know, because you guys are not the raving Schwarzenegger fans in comparison to me, but it's a movie that I've always wanted to talk about because it's both very much a Schwarzenegger vehicle, not just because he drives in the movie, but I actually think it's kind of a seminal movie because of how much shit that's in it that ultimately came to fruition to certain degrees in society. So it's a lot more topical than I thought it would be. I mean, I don't even think you'd have things like The Hunger Games if it wasn't for this. Now, part of that's because of King's short story, but man, I'm excited to talk about this. I mean, look, any movie that has Richard Dawson in it is worth discussing because there's only three of them.
What was the one we discussed earlier this year?
Oh, it was it one of the Lethal Weapon movies?
Yeah. Someone was watching Family Feud on Lethal Weapon. All right, Adam, I'm sure this is a King property you've actually watched, right?
More times than I can count. I can't wait because I get to sit back and listen to puns and impersonations and enjoy myself with that kind of shit. So, Matt, make sure you energize yourself up because I expect it all. You know, it's one of those movies like Demolition Man where you sit back and you go, holy shit, I can't believe this is now a documentary. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, the difference is you can't say that in Demolition Man because you get fined.
That's true. Yeah. They don't have the seashells here, but it's one of those. I was looking forward to getting to this step because, you know, you're going to bring the King aspect to the book. Obviously, this first one we're going to have some fun with because it is an Arnold property through and through. And I can't wait to see what Edgar Wright brings to it because I know nothing other than him and the star. So I'm looking forward to this because if anything else, you know, we're going to be freaking just as lit up as some of these characters are that are in the film.
All right. Well,
it's split.
Make sure you stick around for our review.
Until next week when we discuss The Running Man. Fuck you, podcast. Thank you, boys.
Cujo, what's the matter? Cujo, it's me, Brett. Take it easy, boy.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Let's game, set, and match.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You like this, huh?
It's fun!
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advanced look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more. Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Mad Max movies,
the Exorcist films, the movies of the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Can't miss it.
Cujo, what are you growling at?
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
I need some sugar.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
I'll try and run it up Saturday if I can get the time.
It's okay, I'll take care of it.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Nope, nothing wrong here, folks.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Too much of the tube, guys.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Cut it, Frank. We're wasting our time.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
I don't give a shit! Hear me! I don't give a shit!
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Hey, the truth, I believe him.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
I'll see you.
Louis Teague, I love Alligator. It's not high art, but of all those like Jaws knockoffs, that and Piranha are the best two by far.
My favorite thing about Alligator is the fact that it was written by John Sayles, which blows my mind. Maybe we'll get to it eventually. One more thing.
We have to do pissed off nature.
Right. And do A-ha's version of it, film a few years ago. What was that, Creep? What was the name of that one?
Oh.
Yeah, the one where the chick's stuck in the flood or whatever. I don't remember the name of it. It was pretty good, though.
Yeah. It's also the only one that does not take a lot of elements from Jaws, because all the other ones, Orca, it's a whale, so there is that natural like parallel. Piranha takes place in the water. Grizzly is Jaws in a park.
Yes. Where,
we can't close the state park. We made too much money here.
Oh, I just rewatched that. I don't know, maybe a couple years ago. God, does that movie suck? One more thing I want to mention.
But yeah, I think it's really good. This is not a Courtland Mead situation. But I wanted to actively punch a child in the face. Well, if I did that in that movie, maybe it would have straightened his goddamn teeth out.
Jesus Christ. Adam, how do you feel about the little boy here, sir? Is that him there?
Uh-oh.
Oh, there you go.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Unmute his car.
As I was talking. I think he does a really good job.
And we cut to him driving to the Camber's place, and the boy calls his mom over. And guys, you guys recognize Mr. Camber? Mr. Ed Lauder here? Kind of funny seeing him.
Yeah, this is the guy. He's a comedian.
No, Ed Lauder was a guy. He was in so many things back in the 80s and
90s. So many things.
Stand-up comedian, though.
Was he a stand-up comedian?
Yeah, he was.
Wow.
But great, he did like 200 fucking movies. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, like, anybody who's in Death Wish 3 is okay in my book.
Oh my God. There's a series we need to cover. Donna greets me. So Ted says hi to Beethoven. Jesus Christ. Ted.
That'd be a crossover, Cujo versus Beethoven.
There you go.
Bud comes in to save the day.
Talk about crossovers. Wait till the end of this. I got some news on a remake that they almost did. Ted says hi to.
Oh, what do we got here? Oh, Cujo. Okay. Well, this one shouldn't be too rough. Oh, shoot. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to wag you along there. Jeez, I just can't take these quips out for a walk. All right. No more hot dog in it. Let's go. Cujo, pick one.